Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Today's episode is brought to you by Plexaderm and Grove Collaborative. And of course, yesterday was day one of the impeachment hearings. I have my 10 takeaways up at the Bulwark site. One of the stories that, you know, on Earth 2.0 that would have been the major lead story in every newspaper had it not been for the impeachment proceedings was the extraordinary scene at the White House, though, where you have the president of Turkey standing with the president of the United States, despite the fact that he's an authoritarian thug who recently invaded Syria after we betrayed our Syrian Kurdish allies. So I want to talk about that. And we're fortunate enough to have somebody who knows a great deal about all of these issues. Eric Edelman joins us, a former U.S. ambassador to, well, both Finland and Turkey during the Bush administration. Correct? Do I have this?
Actually, yes, but I was ambassador to Finland under the Bill Clinton administration.
Okay.
Because I was a career foreign service officer.
You are a career foreign service officer. I want to do this. I want to go through your background for the benefit of our listeners, because there is, of course, this question of who are these people in the State Department, in the Foreign Service, who are now coming forward? And, you know, are there people who perhaps know something whose opinions ought to be taken seriously? So Eric, if you'll bear with me, Eric right now is the Roger Hertog Distinguished Practitioner in Residence at the Philip Merrill Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. And Ambassador Edelman retired as a career minister from the U.S. Foreign Service in 2009, and he served in senior positions at the Department of, the Department of Defense and Department of State. He was a DOD's senior policy official overseeing strategy development with global responsibility for bilateral defense relations, war plans, special operations forces, homeland defense, missile defense, nuclear weapons and arms control policies, counter-proliferation, counter-narcotics, counter-terrorism, arms sales, and defense trade controls. And as we just mentioned, he served as U.S. ambassador to Finland under President Clinton and U.S. ambassador to Turkey in the Bush administration. And Ambassador Edelman was Vice President Dick Cheney's Principal Deputy Assistant for National Security Affairs. He was Chief of Staff to Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot, Special Assistant to Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Robert Kimmitt, and Special Assistant to Secretary of State George Shultz. His other assignments include, and this just goes on and on and on, other assignments included the State Department Operations Center, Prague, Moscow, and Tel Aviv, where he's a member of the U.S. Middle East delegation to the West Bank Gaza Autonomy Talks. Ambassador Edelman has been awarded the Department of Defense Medal for Distinguished Public Service, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joint Distinguished Civilian Service Award, the Presidential Distinguished Service Award, and several Department of State Superior Honor Awards. And in 2010, because you just didn't have enough, he was named a Knight of the French National Order of the Legion of Honor. He has a PhD in diplomatic history from Yale. So, Ambassador Edelman, in today's parlance, you would be the complete foreign policy nerd.
Guilty as charged.
Well, let's just talk about this. I want to start with Erdogan, and we'll talk about the what's going on with the impeachment proceedings and the State Department officials who are coming forward. So just give me your sense of what it was like for you to watch President Trump award President Erdogan a White House visit and to see this bromance on the national stage despite all of the things that have happened over the last several months.
Well, I think, you know, it speaks to a couple of different things. One, the attraction that President Trump seems to have for authoritarian leaders and the disinclination he has to work closely with our allies. I mean, the fact that he has a warm relationship with Tayyip Erdogan, who has been taking Turkey further and further down the path domestically of authoritarianism, who has been thwarting U.S. policies in a variety of different areas, who has held U.S. citizens hostage, which is something we normally associate with terrorist groups, not with allies, who continues to imprison employees, locally engaged employees of the U.S. embassy and consulates in Turkey on fabricated charges of sympathies for and support for terrorist groups in Turkey. The fact that he would, you know, honor him with a visit despite all of this, while at the same time having, you know, very negative relations with people like Angela Merkel, just, I think, speaks volumes about sort of where the president's head is on foreign policy. And I think it's in the face in particular of the recent vote in the House to sanction Turkey for a variety of things, including the invasion of northeastern Syria that you mentioned earlier, but also the Turkish purchase of the S-400 Russian air defense missile, which potentially has jeopardized Turkey's participation in the F-35 aircraft program. All of these things, you know, are things that don't merit, you know, being honored and rewarded with a visit.
And yet he was. And as you wrote back in October, so far Erdogan has miraculously walked away without any major diplomatic pushback, sanctions or fines from the United States for all many of these things you were describing, owing to an inexplicable leniency that belies Trump's tough talk. And I think this is one of the most fascinating elements that we sort of know. But I'm trying to understand this fascination that the president has with authoritarian leaders like Erdogan and the weakness that does belie all of the America first, make America proud again. If in any other context, what you would have seen yesterday was a craven act of appeasement. Do you have any theory, operative theory, about what it is about Donald Trump that he despises fellow democratically elected leaders and is fascinated by the world's brutish strongmen?
You know, I hate to try and psychoanalyze, you know, our own president, much less other leaders, but it does seem that he has some attraction to the sort of strongman mythos, and that he, you know, in some sense, I think he is a, you know, strongman wannabe. I don't want to speculate on what, you know, psychological insecurities that, you know, may cover up. But the reality is he talks in the same language as authoritarian leaders, including apparently, you know, in the privacy of his own councils with advisors on things like judges and paying attention to, you know, court decisions, et cetera. So he has a kind of, I think, authoritarian personality and instinct, which I think underpins a lot of this. But there's also potentially other explanations which I think are worth mentioning. So, for instance, NBC has reported, as I think you know, that John Bolton gave a speech to Morgan Stanley in Miami the other day, in which he said, allegedly, according to the folks who listened to him speak and who spoke to NBC, that the breaking point for him with President Trump came over Turkey, and that he could not understand the president's affinity for Erdogan, and the fact that he would routinely accept Erdogan's position on issues going against the unanimous advice of all of his advisors in the national security area, including Secretary Pompeo, Secretary Esper, and others. And the only way he could explain it was with the explanation of venality, that President Trump has private business interests in Turkey, the Trump International Hotel in Istanbul, which provided, as far as Bolton could see, the only explanation for this. So I think that that may well be an explanation as well. And why I think this ought to be of concern to American citizens is you see a persistent pattern, not just in Turkey, but you see it with Saudi Arabia and you see it with Ukraine, of the president deinstitutionalizing U.S. foreign policy and relying instead of the formal mechanism of government for relying instead of that, relying on either family relatives, that is to say, his son-in-law Jared Kushner or his daughter Ivanka Trump, or cronies like Mayor Rudy Giuliani to carry out quasi-governmental actions outside the normal realm of diplomacy. And there are lots of reasons why I think that is ultimately not a sustainable way to conduct a democratic nation's foreign policy.
So his counter to the deep state is what we would call, consider maybe the shallow state, his own shadow government. You know, that is extraordinary that John Bolton would suggest that there was some sort of a conflict of interest, because that would seem to be the grounds for a possible separate impeachment article, if in fact this turns out to be true. So on the issue of, you spend time in Turkey, give me some insight. Because I think that Turkey is very mysterious to many people in the West, because it is both, it has a huge secular secular constituency, but also a very, very strong Islamic tendency. So where does Erdogan straddle this, and how reliable is Turkey? These are two separate questions. And how reliable is Turkey right now as a member of NATO?
Well, let me answer the second question first, because it's a little easier and a little bit more direct answer. The answer is it's not a reliable ally inside NATO, and it hasn't been for a number of years. And I think it's unlikely to be for the foreseeable future, while Erdogan remains in power and while the tendencies that he's given rise to in Turkey continue to play out. And those are, along with the increasing authoritarianism domestically that I mentioned, also a heavy reliance on anti-Americanism in the public media and press, which he almost totally controls at this point, with his efforts to curry favor with Putin and other forces that I think we find inimical to U.S. Interests. So that's a pretty straightforward and easy answer. On the question of Turkey writ large, Turkey is a very, very deeply divided society. And Erdogan really has never represented more than 50% of Turkish society as measured by election results. And his view of democracy is, purely a majoritarian view. By the way, it's a view that not that different from the one that President Trump appears to have, which is, I won the election, therefore I get to do whatever I want, which is not, I think the normal understanding of a constitutional democracy, and particularly a Republican democracy as we have and as Turkey has had since the early 1950s, could possibly be another factor in that. But I think the deeper problem with modern Turkey is that the kind of secular Turkish Republic was created by Atatürk, Kemal Pasha, who was acted by force majeure to take the crumbling Ottoman Empire, disestablish the Sultanate and Caliphate that the Ottomans had represented, and create a modern nation state. But he did it forcibly. It was not necessarily with he had popular support. I don't mean to suggest he didn't, but he did it. He hanged his opponents, political opponents, when they rose against him, and it was done by force majeure. So the result was to establish a society that had, let me put it this way. Lord Kinross, in his biography of Atatürk, says that he accomplished a profoundly liberal end using deeply illiberal means. And the result of that was to leave a number of questions, unanswered, or with provisional answers. One was, what's the role of the state in the economy? By and large, given the disposition of the 1930s and 40s, his answer was a very large state role in the economy, and in endowing so-called 40 families with, key, in the Soviet era we might have called the commanding heights of the Turkish economy. Second, what's the role of ethnicity in the nation? you know, what's the role of religion and society, and what's the role of the military and politics? All of these questions were left somewhat, you know, ambiguous. My view when I was ambassador, and I used to preach this to my embassy staff, is our, you know, our job is to try and help Turkey in order to be a better ally for the United States, and therefore for us to be able to accomplish things together. These imperfections, you know, Dean Acheson at the time of the Greek-Turkish aid bill said in executive session to the Congress that Greece and Turkey were imperfect democracies. The imperfections were the kind of in those areas that I outlined before. My view is the job of U.S. foreign policy was to try and help Turkey, you know, become a more perfect democracy so that it become a better U.S. ally, and therefore we could do things together. Erdogan, since he's come in, has actually tried to provide different answers than what Ataturk would have provided to those, you know, unanswered questions. And in the course of answering those, he has become he comes from a milieu of Islamic movements that wanted to see greater role for Islam, you know, in the state. But he's also come out of a very nationalist environment. Some people have described the political persuasion that he has articulated as Islamo-nationalism, which I think is probably the best description of what he has produced. And it's no accident that the political party that he's now in coalition with, because he does not any longer have the ability to have the AK Party, his political party, in the parliament govern alone, is the Turkish Nationalist Party of Devlet Bahçeli, which is an extreme nationalist party. So what you're seeing is a form of extreme sort of Islamic-tinged nationalism, and there's a populist element. Erdogan himself has described himself as a populist-style politician, and he's been at that for some 16 years. And so in that sense, he's of a piece with larger trends. He may have been one of the earliest examples of a larger trend we've seen globally, but particularly in Europe, of populist-style politicians. You don't just see it there. You see it in the Philippines under Duterte, but you see it in East Central Europe as well. And Erdogan certainly fits that bill.
So,
sorry for the overly long
answer. That's what I asked for. And it brings us to the current domestic political problems that he's faced. He had some significant setbacks in some local elections in Ankara. And the question I guess I would have is the invasion of Syria, the saber rattling, many of the things that are going on that we're seeing on the international stage, how much of that is playing to domestic politics? And so, I mean, talk about that for a moment, because I know that you mentioned in your article back in October that after Trump tweeted out that, well, you know, I'm prepared to utterly destroy the Turkish economy, that really had the effect of gagging the opposition, because it allowed Erdogan then to benefit from a rally around the flag effect in advance of the invasion of Syria. So all of this is playing to his domestic political advantage at a crucial moment in his career as well, isn't it?
That's right. So first of all, I think it's impossible to understand any Turkish foreign policy moves without understanding the domestic context in which they're taking place. Because for Erdogan, there is no distinction between domestic and foreign policy. Everything is part of his domestic policy of surviving politically. And in that sense, he's not much different from Putin, because in neither one of them, because of the corruption and cronyism that has sustained their regimes, can really afford to have a transition that would put them at the mercy of opposition politicians who would hold them to account. The municipal elections were an enormous setback for Erdogan. It's not the first one he had. He had a momentary setback in the parliamentary elections in June of 2015 when he lost the parliamentary majority that he had had almost continuously since 2002, and was forced to, you know, he could no longer govern alone, his party. The municipal elections were an even bigger setback, because a lot of the machinery that he has built as he's made Turkey more and more authoritarian has been from control of local government and the ability of those local governments essentially to collect rents from the economy to finance the AK Party machine. And in the municipal elections earlier this year, he had an enormous setback because he lost the municipal governments in those parts of the country that produce about 70% of Turkey's wealth. So this was really, I think, hard for Americans to understand because it's such a different system than we have. But it was a huge setback for him. And the biggest setback, I mean, you're right that he lost the mayoralty and the council in Ankara, but was losing the mayor's seat in Istanbul, which was where he himself began his political career as mayor of Istanbul. And losing that to the Republican People's Party candidate, İmamoğlu, was a huge, huge setback, one that he couldn't countenance. And so because the vote was close, Erdogan had the vote invalidated and had a rerun of the election, as it were, in June, in which İmamoğlu won an even bigger majority, because I think a lot of Turks were put off by Erdogan's naked display of authoritarianism. And as I said, he's never really had more than 50% of the public on his side. So Turkey is deeply, deeply divided. And when it comes to Syria, his Syria policy has never been terribly popular. And one of the things that my co-author, Aykan Erdemir, who's a former Turkish parliamentarian, now resident in the United States, and I pointed out in the article that you mentioned, Charlie, in Foreign Policy in October, is that Erdogan is very reliant in this military operation in northeastern Syria on proxies. And these proxies are the so-called Syrian Free Army. There are a lot of kind of repurposed jihadists from Syria who the Turks have trained to do their bidding. And they are the shock troops here. I mean, you may have seen a piece in the Wall Street Journal the other day suggesting that we've got overhead video, you know, of these forces committing atrocities. Jim Jeffrey, my successor, a couple of times removed as ambassador and a good Foreign Service colleague who's back in government working for Secretary Pompeo, has testified before Congress that these forces are guilty, in his words, of war crimes. There's a reason why he's using those forces and not Turkish regular forces for most of the combat operations involved here. And that is that the prospect of, you know, young Turkish boys coming back in body bags from Syria into Turkey is not something that, you know, would wash well politically for him, and shows, I think, the fragility of his hold on public opinion when it comes to Syria. And that's why the president's tweet about, you know, I'll crush the economy was so damaging, because it basically made it very, you know, if the president of the United States is, you know, presenting an existential threat to Turkey as far as Turks are concerned, it's very hard then to, criticize your president for running counter to what Trump is doing in Syria.
So back to yesterday. Obviously, these events have helped him politically, I'm assuming domestically. But from his point of view, where he has defied the United States over and over again, buying the anti-aircraft system from the Russians, clearly rolling over American warnings not to go into Syria, and there he is being rewarded with this joint press conference. How does Erdogan view Donald Trump at this point? How does he view America? He's clearly no longer afraid to defy us because he's defied us with absolute impunity. What message did we send to him?
So I think, unfortunately, and this is not just something one has to lay at the feet of Donald Trump, although he's a big part of it. But there's been a tradition, including, you know, among some of my colleagues in the State Department, to regard Turkey as being too big to fail. It's too important an ally to fail.
Exactly.
No matter what.
Too strategically important.
Too strategically important. It's a pivotal state. So no matter what they do, we have to continue to treat them like an ally in the hope that if we keep doing that, eventually they'll act like an ally. And, you know, this is, validation in my view of the, old Einstein's, a rule that the definition of insanity is the, repetition of the same thing over and over again, anticipating a different result. So I think no matter how many times we step on that same rake, we don't seem to be able to, get our minds around the fact that, Turkey's on a different kind of trajectory. We need to develop a different kind of policy for dealing with it. By the way, the previous administration under President Obama was equally guilty of this, in my view, up until the last couple of years of the administration. But from 2009 to, say, about 2013, to run the Gezi Park demonstrations in Turkey, President Obama said that Erdogan was one of his five best friends among world leaders overseas, and they had their own particular kind of bromance that anticipated the Trump bromance. What Erdogan has learned from this is it doesn't matter what the bureaucracy in the United States says. It, what matters is my relationship with Obama or Trump or members of their family because of the connections that his son-in-law, who is now, I think, the deputy prime minister and I think maybe finance minister as well, is in charge of the economy overall, Minister Albayrak, his relations with Jared Kushner, my relationship with Trump, that's going to be the winning card to play against these bureaucrats who may, have in the State Department or Defense Department who may have other ideas, or the Congress of the United States, which might want to sanction me. I can get Trump to fend off those sanctions, no matter whether I'm buying.
It's strongman to strongman, right? Okay, right. So I do want to talk about the impeachment proceedings and the whole question of who sets American foreign policy. But one last question about the meeting yesterday. Apparently, according to Axios, this Oval Office meeting took a rather dark, weird turn when Erdogan pulled out his iPad and made a group of senators watch a propaganda film that depicted the Kurds as terrorists. And apparently there were five Republican senators who were among the vocal critics of Turkey, and they were pushing back on him on the invasion of Syria. And apparently he thought he could sway the senators by making them watch this clunky propaganda film, and apparently it did not go well. So this is a reflection of what you're thinking, that he's in the Oval Office. Donald Trump is, all he needs to worry about is Trump. And yet apparently his attempt to sway the Republican senators didn't go well. I imagine that was a somewhat irritating moment for the Turkish leader.
Yeah. And, when I heard, I think I probably only heard it either yesterday morning or maybe the night before, that the president had in mind bringing some members of the Congress in to meet with Erdogan. I thought the meeting could go sideways a lot of ways, but I hadn't anticipated the iPad, I have to confess.
you don't see that coming.
But it did strike me that it might not go very well, because in my own meetings with members of Congress when I was ambassador with Erdogan, I always found those meetings to be, kind of nail-biting, white-knuckle events, because his manner with them is always pretty brusque and sort of contemptuous, in part because I think it betrays his assumption that, members of the United States Congress are kind of akin to, Turkish parliamentarians, which is to say, they're kind of a nuisance, but I don't really have to take, them into account seriously.
So that probably did not go well, and probably did not strengthen his case in Congress in fighting off sanctions.
No, and
although we got Lindsey Graham apparently to block the resolution memorializing the Armenian Holocaust.
Right. So, I think from the president's point of view and from Erdogan's point of view, although as we look at it, we say this didn't really go well. The truth is, when I was ambassador, there was a fund of support for Turkey in the Congress. There was an active Turkey caucus. There were a lot of people who understood Turkey was important, et cetera. today, because of all the issues we've discussed in the U.S.-Turkish relationship, or, you know, earlier in this podcast, there is no fund of support in the Congress for Turkey. There's actually mostly different levels of how much and how broadly we should punish Turkey, and I don't think the meeting did anything to change that. But having said that, I think it remains to be seen whether Erdogan's bet on Trump doesn't continue to pay off, because from his point of view, Trump, I am sure, is going to tell the members of Congress, look, you had your chance to, you know, vent, you know, your criticisms at Erdogan. I gave you that. I need you to buy me some time and space, because I want to negotiate this great, big, wonderful trade deal that's going to take our bilateral two-way trade from, you know, $20 billion a year to $100 billion a year, which is, you know, having broken my pick on this as ambassador, you know, 15 years ago, this is, you know, total pie in the sky. I mean, there's limitations to how much we can do, in part driven by the Turkish EU free trade agreement. Europe is a much more important market for Turkey than we are. So there's limits to how quickly or rapidly you can drive trade from $20 billion to $100 billion. Moreover, there's this somewhat nebulous idea of coming up with some kind of solution to the S-400 problem that would be analogous to something we did 20 years ago with Greece and Cyprus with regard to the then S-300 missiles that were purchased at that time, which is to basically keep the missiles in their crates. Don't operationalize them, don't turn on the radar so it doesn't jeopardize F-35. And in the meantime, Turkey will buy U.S. Patriot missiles. The Turks have said, and Erdogan has said, we're open to buying Patriot. I'm sure the president is going to use all of this to say, I'm working the problem. Please don't impose sanctions. You know, there's already, I think, a disposition in Senate Majority Leader McConnell's view and in his office not to proceed too far with sanctions, which some of which, by the way, there's legitimate concern about how these sanctions are put together and what kind of sanctions package you put together. I mean, I do think they should be targeted. They should be targeted on Erdogan, on his Syria policy, on the S-400 transaction, on some of his cronies, and not broadened out to you know, attack the entire Turkish economy, as the president said in his tweet, because I don't think you want these sanctions to be anti-Turkish, you want them to be anti-Erdogan. And so
no,
it may be that, you know, Erdogan turns out to win his bet on Trump holding off sanctions.
At the moment, I would not bet against him. Okay, I want to turn to the impeachment proceedings, which turns on another area of foreign policy, American relations with Ukraine, and the testimony, to get your take on the testimony of William Taylor and George Kent yesterday. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor. Did you know that 70% of people say they want to use natural products, but only 2% do? That's why Grove Collaborative makes finding healthy, affordable, effective products easy and convenient. And now, more than 500,000 American households shop Grove for their healthy home essentials. Grove Collaborative is the online marketplace that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal products directly to you. They take the guesswork out of going green. Every Grove product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. My first box arrived, and it had just an incredible array of products that my wife and I are going to be trying out. I mean, it is an amazing smorgasbord of choices. Then they deliver all of your home essentials right to your front door, and they have this huge selection of sustainable plant-based products, including all the big brands that I love and I trust, like Mrs. Meyers and Method. Everything they carry is safer for you, better for the planet, and it really works. In place of the harsh chemicals, they use natural ingredients that smell fresh and leave your house sparkling. Look, we're all busy. I certainly am. And I know that I don't have time to waste buying detergent and toilet paper, and neither do you. So give it a try and get some me time back in your day. Because with Grove, you don't have to shop multiple stores or search endlessly online to get all the natural goods you need for you and your family. They have everything that I need in one place, which, given how I look, I don't want to spend a lot of time doing this, but I want to get quality stuff. So, and they have the best selection of natural home and personal care products. Things for the house, my grandkids, my dog, even some fun personal things for me. So join more than 500,000 families who trust Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, the shipping is fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/bulwark, you'll get a free 5-piece gift set from Mrs. Meyer's and festive holiday scents like peppermint or Iowa pine. So go to grove.co/bulwark to get this exclusive holiday offer. That's grove.co/bulwark.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends. And the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit tryplexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's tryplexiderm.com.
Okay, we are back with Ambassador Eric Edelman. We've been talking about the bizarre meeting between the president and Turkish leader Erdogan yesterday. I want to get your take on watching these career foreign service officers testify one after another in the impeachment proceedings. Just give me your general reaction to watching Bill Taylor and George Kent yesterday in front of that congressional committee.
Well, full disclosure requires me to tell you that Bill Taylor is someone I've known and worked with for nearly 30 years. I admire him enormously. I think he's a great professional, although he is not technically a foreign service officer, but he has worked in the national security business as a civil servant for nearly 30 years and did serve as ambassador to Ukraine with I think great distinction, and now volunteered at the request of Secretary of State Mike Pompeo to go back to fill in as chargé d'affaires in Ukraine after Masha Yovanovitch, the then ambassador to Ukraine, was pulled out because she had lost President Trump's confidence, apparently, as a result of a whispering campaign that a number of the president's friends and allies were involved in, attacking her as being a never-Trumper or not being supportive of the president or what have you. I did not watch the entire proceeding yesterday. Was like a lot of Americans, I suspect, going about my regular life. I actually had teaching responsibilities yesterday that took up a bit of my time at SICE. So, but having read the transcripts of their earlier closed door testimony and having seen some of what they said and having heard some of the opening statements and some of the questioning by members. I mean, I do believe that what you saw was two very dedicated public servants testifying to the best of their ability about what they believe are facts and trying not to get themselves caught up in the sort of partisan crossfire about the nature of this inquiry and, its legitimacy, et cetera.
There seems to be this underlying question that I think a lot of Republicans have been raising, which is the question of who makes foreign policy and who is in charge of foreign policy. And the assumption there is that all of these professionals within the State Department exist only to carry out the president's wishes, that the president makes the foreign policy, and that these are – deep state operatives or bureaucrats who should not have their own views, who should not be pushing their own agendas, whose role is simply to execute what the president wants. So if the president decides that this is what he wants Ukraine to do, then their job is simply to make that happen, that there is no foreign policy separate from the president's whims, I guess. So I'd like to get your take on all of that, because that seems to be a sort of a running theme among some of the defenders of the president.
Well, I think the president does, under the Constitution, have enormous authority in foreign affairs. And I think one of the things, putting on not my Foreign Service hat, but my historian's hat for a second, one thing you see about certainly modern presidents since the Second World War, many of them gravitate towards foreign policy, even if their original backgrounds more incline them to domestic policy, in part because domestic policy is much more complicated by congressional authorizations and appropriations and as a result, domestic politics. And their scope of action is much, much greater in foreign policy. That doesn't mean, however, that they are monarchs and that they can act, you know, on whim. You know, yes, they can dismiss ambassadors. We all serve at the pleasure of the president. Certainly that was my view when I was Bill Clinton's ambassador to Finland and George W. Bush's ambassador to Turkey. The president must work with the Congress, which still has the power of the purse and the power to authorize foreign assistance. And he works within a tradition. I mean, our foreign policy, although there have been plenty of partisan fights over it, there's actually been a lot of bipartisan continuity. If you look at U.S. policy towards Ukraine, beginning with the independence of Ukraine, the referendum that followed the failed coup against Mikhail Gorbachev that led to the agreement that Yeltsin made with the then Ukrainian leadership, the United States has consistently, across administrations of both parties, attempted to help Ukraine become a more self-sufficient, less corrupt polity that was able of standing on its own so that it wouldn't be subject to Russian interference or Russian pressure, whether that pressure was economic or political. And so it's I don't think the president, you know, can act with, you know, total, you know, freedom of action. He's got enormous scope. But I think the limiting factor has got to be that he's acting on behest of the United States of America, not his personal interest. And that's, I think, the issue here, whether what he was doing was in the U.S. national interest or in his personal political interest. And, you know, that is why I think you have, you know, the impeachment clauses of the Constitution written as they are, because the founders were worried about foreign interference in American politics, understandably, given the times in which they lived. And therefore, the Emoluments Clause, the Impeachment Clause were efforts to prevent presidents from falling under the sway of foreign powers or inviting foreign powers to intercede or intervene in U.S. affairs to their personal benefit.
Well, no, that is an important point, because you clearly have within the Constitution the concern about the concern to constrain the president's hand on foreign policy. So without giving,
and that's why bribery, yeah, you know, and foreign emoluments are specifically called out.
So without breaking any confidences, you must be in touch with other people who have been, you know, career civil servants, career foreign service officers. What is the morale right now within the State Department, within the Foreign Service community, given what's going on, playing out, not just in the context of Ukraine, but in the context of what's happened in Turkey, what's happened in Syria, the president's clear contempt for much of that permanent government?
Well, I think, you know, I want to caveat what I'm about to say by noting that morale in the State Department is, you know, traditionally not great. I mean, One of the things people always note about the Department of State is that unlike other of the government departments in the cabinet, most of which are concerned with domestic political affairs and things that, you know, immediately impact American citizens, you know, kind of in their daily lives, the Department of Education, the Department of Agriculture, the EPA, et cetera, all of those agencies do things or are engaged in programs that, you know, have a domestic constituency because they're, you know, they are serving some very particular need that Americans are likely to be aware of at some level. The State Department and the Foreign Service are traditionally without a constituency in the Congress or in the public because they represent the nation's foreign affairs. It's relatively remote from the considerations of most Americans. It's essentially a free good that they don't, you know, a public good that they don't think about very much because they don't get some immediate pecuniary benefit from it. And therefore, they're not likely to value it, you know, very much. Moreover, the State Department is the only part of the government that actually recruits by examination. And therefore, it is by definition an elitist, you know, institution. Now, it used to be regarded as a kind of Ivy League, you know, elitist institution. And since I have two Ivy League degrees, I'm probably particularly open to that, you know, charge of being an Ivy League elitist. The reality is the Foreign Service, certainly over the time, the 30 years that I was in from, you know, January 1980 until January 2009, became much more broadly diverse than it had been, both in terms of its gender composition, its you know, ethnic composition, and certainly the, you know, range of educational institutions that it drew from. But it's always been regarded as a kind of elitist, you know, striped pants, cookie pusher. So there's always a bad morale problem there.
But is the president right to be concerned? Okay, why is it worse now?
It's worse now, I think, because of a series of failures on the part of both Secretaries Tillerson and Pompeo to appear to value the expertise of the Foreign Service, to employ it on behalf of the United States. I mean, Foreign Service officers are, in my experience, apolitical in the sense that they have – that doesn't mean they don't have political views. I happen to have, relatively speaking, conservative political views for the Foreign Service. I would say probably the majority are, you know, more liberal than I was. I suspect that, you know, overwhelmingly they – probably their voting pattern is much more to support Democratic candidates and Republican candidates. But in their professional work, my experience is that they do not make that distinction, that they're very conscious of the fact that the American people elect our leaders and we as professional diplomats are meant to give our best diplomatic advice to those leaders and their appointees as they craft policies. But once they make policy, our job is to execute that policy. What I think has happened here is there's been a sort of diminution of reliance on the Foreign Service. I mean, my experience is, so I was, you mentioned earlier, I was special assistant to George Shultz when he was secretary for Ronald Reagan. You know, I suspect that, you know, probably 80% or more of my Foreign Service colleagues did not vote for Ronald Reagan. I did, but I bet you most of them did not. I don't know. I never asked. But what they valued was that George Shultz, you know, recognized their expertise, solicited their views, took their views into account, but then provided them with very real guidance about what the president was trying to accomplish and get them to help him accomplish that as best he could. And the Foreign Service was quite happy to do that, in my experience. And what I think is missing now is that sense of soliciting the advice, that the advice is being heard. There's a sense that even the notion of a non-political career service is being dispensed with, and that people who are like Ambassador Yovanovitch, who are doing their jobs, are being, you know, subject to whispering campaigns that lead to them being relieved from their positions. And I think the failure to defend her, the failure to defend the notion of an apolitical career foreign service that seeks to help the president execute his policies, is being lost. And I think that's what you saw in the statement of my former colleague, Mike McKinley. And I have to, in full disclosure, you know, I've worked with Ambassador McKinley. He's a friend. I haven't seen him in a number of years because he's been off serving the country in a variety of posts. But he and I at one point were both special assistants to Bob Kimmett, worked in the same office together. Have an enormously high regard for him, as did, I think, Secretary Pompeo, which is why Pompeo brought him into his own office to try and, you know, repair some of the damage that I think Pompeo correctly understood had been done during the Tillerson reign.
Ambassador Eric Edelman, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us today on the Bulwark Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Charlie. It's been a pleasure.
We appreciate it very much. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Plexiderm and Grove Collaborative. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over.